Okay, this is Gary Parrish again. It's the I Own College Basketball Podcast again, and I'm now talking to you on the morning of December 30th, which I suppose is the eve of New Year's Eve or something. Either way, because it's Monday, I'm joined, as usual, by my CBS colleagues Jeff Porzello and Matt Norlander, and I'm assuming that they are in their homes this morning, but I am not at home. I'm at the local Baptist Women's Hospital waiting for the doctors to give us the okay to leave so that we can take our newborn young Oliver Parrish home. So yes, I'm going to assume, and you guys tell me if this is a safe assumption, that this is the first ever college basketball podcast of any kind recorded from a maternity ward. Are we making podcast history today?
I think we are.
I hope so. I mean, I don't know. I hope there's not that many going on.
And is this something I should be doing? Should I be with my family or should I be recording?
No, you spent all weekend with them.
Oh God, you have no idea how much I've spent all weekend with them. It is you guys don't have children, so you don't understand. And I have a 10-year-old. We have a 10-year-old, and so it had been a long time. I think I'd forgotten how much babies do not sleep. They just do not sleep. And actually, I think our reality was distorted a little bit by our first child, Aiden, because he did. He slept through the night pretty well, like from start to finish. Once he got to about 14 months, he started getting up in the middle of the night. But as a baby, as a newborn, he slept pretty well. This kid here, my God, he wakes up every 45 minutes. It's just, I don't know what to do with him.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, congratulations.
I've tried that. It's just, it'll be easier to ignore when we're back at home, where there's actually places you can run off to if you need to. In a maternity ward, you just have a room. It's like she's in the bed, he's like in his little deal, I'm on the couch, and we're just sort of, it's hard to ignore when he's 3 feet from you.
Yeah, where are you right now, by the way?
Okay, I have got – the nurses here are just terrific, right? They're so good. Because it's Monday, they knew that the podcast had to be recorded. So this morning when they came in to check –
They knew?
Yeah,
they were talking. They were like, oh, you're the host.
Word on the street.
Yeah, they were like – well, they came in and they said – they said, Mr. Parrish? And I said, yes, come on in. They said, can we come in? I said, of course you could come in. You're the nurse, for crying out loud. And so you don't even have to ask. And so they come in and they said, all right, we just wanted to check Oliver's vitals. And I said, that's perfect. And we just wanted to check on Kelly. And I said, of course, that's really nice. And they said, where are you planning to record the Eye on College Basketball podcast today? Because we've been out at the nurse's station and we don't know if this is something that needs to be done around the child. And I said, I appreciate you thinking of me. And I was going to actually bring this up to you guys, and long story not so long, they gave me my own little private room. It's the podcast room in the maternity ward.
That's
a little studio you have. That's
yeah, cool. I have like a little studio now. And Borzello, you should have a child so that you could get a maternity ward studio so that you wouldn't echo all the time.
Yeah, I know. Now that I'm back in New York, I have nothing that echoes again. I got to go back to North Carolina.
Should be recording this every Monday from North Carolina. No, the people here have been really terrific, and everything's perfect. I know a lot of people on Twitter have asked, and yes, the lack of sleep is not ideal, but you know, it's when we talked last Monday, the due date was actually today, December 30th. I was operating under the assumption we would have the child at some point this afternoon. We had the child early Friday, actually. And it's just such a big relief. Anybody who's a parent understands, like, you really, it's sort of a weird point of view because we don't really have control over anything, like whether we drive through a green light and somebody runs a red light and blasts us and paralyzes us forever or kills us. We, you know, if a drunk driver turns into our lane, if we're going to get cancer, either as a child or an adult, like the reality is you don't have control over any of these things. And yet the only time that ever registers with me, like total lack of control over your own well-being or life, is like when the two times, actually. One is when we were having Aiden, and now this one. And so for 9 months, it's not a constant like worry, but it never really goes away. And so you just have this huge sense of relief, like when the baby's actually born and everything is seemingly okay. I mean, he's a little on the light side, 5 pounds, he was 5 pounds. And so he's tiny, but he's also as healthy as can be. So it's been a nice 3 days, to be here and sort of a relieving 3 days as well. But we are looking forward to getting back home and getting on some sort of normal schedule.
Little Ollie Parrish.
Yeah, little Oliver.
OCP.
I tried, trust me, Kelly was slightly out of it when they came in with the birth certificate lady. And I tried to put down Oliver Purnell Parrish, but she woke up in the middle. And so, no, you want to know, remember, did I talk to you guys about the middle name issue?
Yes, that was last week's podcast.
So, okay, yeah. Okay. So listen to this. This is how. Okay, remember how I was against Carter? The name is Oliver Carter Parrish, and I was against. I said I want Oliver as a first name, or I'll take Carter as a first name. Somehow, from that conversation, she decided that the name would be Oliver Carter Parrish. Well, I liked Oliver and I liked Carter, but I didn't like Oliver and Carter together. And so I expressed this well in advance, like 2-3 months ago. For whatever reason, she thought once she had it in her head that the name was Oliver Carter Parrish, that it was just going to be Oliver Carter Parrish and there was no changing it, even though it could have easily been changed because it wasn't official yet. Bottom line, I gave up on that fight because you just had to. It was going to be I was never going to win it, so I just quit. So the true story is that when the birth certificate lady came in, I had run downstairs to get some breakfast stuff, for Kelly and for Aiden was up here and went to get some stuff. So I just left it alone. Well, then she comes back yesterday afternoon, so it was a little sweet lady, and she comes back with a copy of the birth certificate, like the preliminary copy, and she says, "Hey, I just wanted to get you to review this." Kelly was actually on the phone with somebody, and she said, "Well, you can review it." And I said, "Yeah, I'll review it. It'll be fine." I said, "Just stand right here. I'll hand it right back to you." So I look at the birth certificate. This thing says Oliver Carter Jean Parrish. She is randomly thrown in a Jean. No. All right? Because
you
her
four names.
Now the kid's got four names. And so it's the most infuriating thing ever. So
I'm
like,
OCGP.
OCJP, right? And I'm like, what is going on with Jean? Where did this cuz we have this is not even a name that we've discussed ever. And it turns out that her grandmother at some point over the last 3 days told her it would mean a lot cuz her grandmother is Dorothy Jean. And her grandmother, it would mean a lot if we could throw a Gene in there. Or either you know Kelly.
It would mean a lot if you could throw a Matthew in there.
I know, right? Let's just add another name.
Throw a Brozello.
Yes. I mean, long we're adding names, hell, let's just throw in everything we want, right? If we can get Gene in there, I don't know why we can't get Purnell in there. And so I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, do you realize how much I didn't want Carter as the middle name? And she said, yeah, but you know, we decided that would be okay. I said, and then you won that fight, and then you randomly threw Gene in while I wasn't looking. Like, would it be okay if somebody handed you a birth certificate and it had Oliver Purnell? I actually said Oliver Purnell Parrish on it. Like, that would you would think I just violated. Oh,
that
would
have been the greatest thing ever. No joke. That would have been unbelievable.
What if I would actually put Oliver Purnell Parrish on the birth certificate and they handed it to Kelly and they were like, hey, just need you to sign off on this. She would have been furious at me thinking I'm trying to get one over on her. And yet I randomly got a Gene on the birth certificate now. I don't even know my kid's name. I don't even know why my kid's name
is. Next time you get to name something, you guys get to name something, you have to pick it. And you have to name it Purnell.
Purnell, we get a dog or another dog or something. Anyway, so that's that. And for everybody who has sent nice notes on Twitter or Facebook or wherever it is they send nice notes, I appreciate it. It's been really nice. It's been a great experience, and it's gone actually better than. I don't want to say that I anticipate it because it's what you always anticipate, but you're never quite sure if it's going to go smoothly, and this has gone remarkably smoothly. So thank you. Anyway,
so hoops-wise, well, yeah. Borzell and I were obviously around all day Saturday, watched all the games, but did you even get to see?
I watched more basketball on television on Saturday than I've ever watched. Here's the thing about having a newborn. They don't need me much, you know? Yeah. Like, I'm there to hold them and, like tell him how cute he is and take a picture every once in a while. But like, I'm of no importance here. Like, the baby is either sleeping.
Your job is done.
My job's done. Right. Yeah. 9 months ago.
9 months ago. Exactly.
Yeah. The baby is either sleeping, which is very rare. He's actually never sleeping or he wants to be fed. Right. And I'm not in any position to feed him. And so I really don't have much to do. The problem becomes, so like one of our bosses, Tony Moss, was like, hey, man, I appreciate you being on this stuff, but you don't have to be. I'm like, dude, I got nothing else to do. Like, I'm just sitting here. And it's like I can't even sleep. So it's like you're awake. You guys might have seen it. I filed the top 25 and won the other night at like 3 in the morning because it's just like I'm awake. So really, I go to sleep and I wake up every 45 minutes, and then I get Oliver and I get him out of his little whatever the hell he's sleeping in, and I hand him to Kelly, and then she feeds him, and then I try to go back to sleep, and then I wake up again in 45 minutes, and that's pretty much been the schedule. And so I say that to say on Saturday at 1 o'clock Central Time, I settled in Syracuse, Villanova, Kentucky, Louisville. Then Missouri, NC State, then UCLA, Alabama. I watched every minute of pretty much every minute of four straight games. And I want to get to that Saturday because it was an interesting Saturday. But I do want to start with, I guess, something that was a little overshadowed heading into the weekend, but a big development nonetheless. Mitch McGarry, the sophomore All-American, going to have back surgery, presumably, given that it's December 30th and he hasn't had the surgery yet. It's going to be out for the season. Let's start with you, Borzo. How badly does this hurt Michigan as a basketball team? We'll talk McGarry in just a second. What does this do for Michigan? Can they make the NCAA tournament without him?
I mean, I think it's going to be tough because they have not been that great without him. I mean, they've struggled a lot, with him. And I think without him, you know, who are they going to go to in the front court? I think they're going to rely a lot more on Glenn Robinson III and Nick Stauskas and those, and especially Glenn Robinson III. He has struggled a little bit without Trey Burke, and McGarry did too. And now, you know, I just don't know if they have the firepower to win enough Big Ten games. I mean, the top of the Big Ten is pretty deep. Without McGarry, are they even a top five Big Ten team? Are they a top six Big Ten team? You know, I don't know. I think that, you know, we have to see over the next couple of weeks, you know, how they figure out to get production from the front court. They seem to still be figuring out their roles, especially with the freshman point guard. And to take out, you know, your, you know, preseason All-American big man right before conference play, I think it's going to be really, really tough to overcome.
See, I think, Norlander, and you tell me what you think, but I think they could maybe still be, if the question is, can they be top five Big Ten? If they can, that's going to be good enough. I'm just not sure they can be top five Big Ten. I mean, we're talking Ohio State, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan State. At this point, all seem undeniably better than Michigan, even with McGarry. They have been better than Michigan. Okay, so then you throw in Minnesota, which is surprisingly okay. They're 34th at KenPom right now. They're sitting at 11-2. Richard Pitino's doing a really nice job there. Indiana's Indiana. You got to think they I don't know that they're going to be great, but can be probably better than Michigan without McGarry. Illinois sitting here at 11-2. Purdue is haven't really won any significant games, but they're 10-3. I just don't know that Michigan can do top five in the Big Ten anymore. Do you?
I don't know if they can right now. 8-4 team. They only have conference games remaining. That Big Ten slate starts Thursday at Minnesota. If they lose that, they'll be 8-5. They're projected on trustykenpom.com. Projected at 18-12 heading into the Big Ten tournament. I would think if they're at 18-12, and again, a lot of this is where you get your wins and where your losses come from. But I would think they're going to need two Big Ten tournament wins. And if you told me they were 20-12 going into Selection Sunday, I'd say they're going to make the tournament. I say they will make the tournament, but very much in that 11-12 seed range. Stauskas has been very solid this year, and Glenn Robinson has been pretty damn good as well. McGarry was just never effective, and I think it was as much the back as it was not having Trey Burke. I think Burke last year did help him a lot. This team still has talent overall. Just isn't nearly defensively what I thought it would be. It wasn't a great defensive team last year either. It was just so amazing on offense. I was expecting it to be a little bit better on the defensive side, but it hasn't been the case at all. Non-conference wise, they have an OT win over Florida State, an improved Florida State team, by the way, kind of a sneaky good FSU team, relatively speaking. But other than that, Stanford is okay, but I don't think they're going to be a tournament team. So Michigan, you know, it's probably a holding pattern year. You know, at this point, if you're a Wolverines fan, make the tournament. If you get to the round of 32, then it's almost house money at that point, which sounds weird because, you know, expectations preseason, this was a Big Ten, top 10 team and certainly considered top two, maybe even number one. People weren't sure if it was them or Michigan State in the Big Ten, but that's anything but the case now.
So this is obviously going to start a conversation about kids risking a potential lottery pick to return to school. I don't know where you guys stand on this. I used to, And I actually wrote about this from Orlando, a month ago or so when I was writing about Marcus Smart. I used to have the opinion of if you're a projected lottery pick and you do not go, you're being dumb. You're being reckless and you're being dumb and you're stupid. And I would call you stupid. I actually believe that I called Roy Hibbert stupid one time, which in hindsight is just ridiculous because A, Roy Hibbert's not stupid. I mean, if you've ever been around him and listened to him speak, he's just, he's a Georgetown grad. Like, he's not a stupid guy, all right? So I was, my whole theory was rooted in a fallacy. Beyond that, he didn't cost himself anything. he's been terrific, which is another place where I was wrong. I didn't think he would be a high-level pro, and yet he's one of the top bigs in the world. And so I actually don't think there's any player that I've ever been wrong about more than Roy Hibbert. But, my point was, I actually called him. Like I said, this is dumb. This is stupid. Like, he's coming back to school. I think my years add up. He came back to school to be a senior in the year that Greg Oden was going to be a freshman. So my point was, even if he's great, he's not going to he's losing places in the draft. How could this kid do this? Over the years, I don't know whether it's I've just decided to open my mind a little bit, or maybe I've just become wiser with my years or whatever. I've decided that I will never criticize somebody for returning to school, regardless of where they're projected to go into the NBA, as long as they know the pros and the cons, as long as they are educated on the possible risk. Because I don't know if Marcus Smart is the one that taught me this, but I find him incredibly mature in talking about this. He says, listen, I might be risking money and I might lose some money, but I don't care because I value the experience that I'm having right now, like living around campus with my best friend, being an All-American, being in college, being a kid, having fun, dominating other players. Like, I'm having a good time. And maybe it's going to cost me $3 million or $5 million or $7 million. But if I'm going to make $50 million, $80 million, $100 million anyway, maybe it's worth it. You know, would if you go back and ask Carmelo Anthony if he could have turned pro out of high school or had that 1 year, how much does that 1 year mean to him? And so I've just sort of changed my approach on this. And so I guess I say that to say this. Mitch McGarry was educated on the process. He was educated about the possible risk. And so I'm not going to be somebody who writes the column saying Mitch McGarry should have turned pro and everybody else should turn pro because this is what can happen. But that said, here we are. He was a projected lottery pick, and now he's, I guess, probably a borderline first-round pick who's going to spend his entire sophomore year, most of it anyway, on the sidelines. This isn't ideal, is it, Borzello?
No, and I think that, you know, even without the injury, his stock was dropping, as we've seen throughout the first, you know, whatever month, I guess, how many games he's played. But he struggled a lot without Trey Burke. He, and in the NCAA tournament last year, he looked awesome. You know, he was dominating. He was running the floor, and he was, like you said, he was a projected lottery pick. You know, Glenn Robinson III was the same way, and both guys could have been, you know, lock first-rounders after last year. Both decided to come back, and obviously Glenn Robinson III can play his way back into, you know, to the mix, but McGarry, you know, we're not going to see him again for a few months. He's the what we've seen of him the past couple of months has not been great, and, you know, I would say, obviously I said last year he should have gone pro, but I'm not going to blame it on his injury. He still should have gone pro because he would have, you know, had a higher stock last year. It's just unfortunate that, you know, he's not going to really have a chance to bounce back from a struggling start.
I think that, to me, I'm not sure how good of a pro McGarry will be, but when he was looking so good last year in March, and obviously the conversation about what he would be like at the next level started escalating, I don't know. To me, I always saw McGarry as someone, if he ever stayed all 4 years, I think he would be a great college player for 4 years and then maybe have a chance to make a roster and maybe have a little bit of impact at the pro level. But if he, you know, if he chooses to go even after this, I don't know what his stock will be in Philly, even if that'll even be an option. But if he does come back, I think his game will ultimately be better for it. Michigan will be better for it. To me, he just seems like a really solid 4 year college guy that might get the most out of that option, but we'll see. And by the way, I don't know the state of his back. I'm just saying, generally speaking, with back injuries, I would not recommend he come back and not try and rush it, because obviously those things can be so tricky. I mean, from basketball to football to hockey to baseball, back injuries have ruined the career of many a player or derailed it for years at a time just because they can be so sensitive. So if he's really got an issue here, I would wait and certainly give it a full offseason to train and get to 100%.
You know, I'm not going to say, you know, shoulda, coulda, woulda, based off of the injury, because contrary to popular belief, I got into an argument on Twitter with somebody about this. Actually, when I wrote that Marcus Smart column, because the guy was just infuriated that I wouldn't mention the risk of injury in coming back to Marcus Smart, with Marcus Smart coming back to school. And my point was, listen, Marcus Smart understands all this stuff. Like, I don't believe anybody understood what he was risking by returning to Oklahoma State better than Marcus Smart. But then that conversation sort of evolved into a conversation about the risk of injuries. And the truth is, if you are a projected lottery pick and you return to school, you are, quote, risking something because of injury. Like, you know, surely, you could.
Yeah.
But it is very rare, very, very rare that someone who is a projected lottery pick then returns to school is somehow has their professional career derailed because of an injury. And like this guy on Twitter, and I don't remember who it was, but he said, what Marcus Smart is one bad injury now away from ending up in the D League. Well, which is just stupid because, first off, he's the idea of having one bad injury like that, it's very, very rare. It is remarkably unlikely to happen. Secondly, there is no injury that Marcus Smart could have that would put him in the D-League. Like, that injury does not exist. Yeah. Torn ACL, two torn ACLs, 15 broken ankles. He's not going to the D-League. Like, and I kept coming back to this guy. Tell me, and I said, okay, listen, I will accept your hypothetical as a possibility as long as this. You can tell me one ever top 10 pick projected guy who suffered an injury and then went from top 10 pick to the D League. If you can name one guy that's ever happened to, then I'll listen to you. Otherwise, you're just being silly. It's like me worrying about getting on an airplane because if it crashes, I'll die. Well, yes, if it crashes, I'll die. But it's probably not going to crash. The odds of it are very, very low. So I'm not going to sit here and go, see, this is why you can't. You got to turn pro because what if you get hurt? Well, like, this is, I think you used the right word, unfortunate. This is unfortunate, but it's not some lesson there. But here is something, though, that I think is interesting that I don't think applies to Marcus Smart, but might apply to Mitch McGarry and maybe Glenn Robinson as well. And this is not something you would ever tell yourself because it's not what you would believe about yourself. But how much was your draft stock tied to another individual? How much did – listen, Marcus Smart is great because he's Marcus Smart, period. You can take Marcus Smart, put him with four dudes. It doesn't matter who they are. Put him at Oklahoma State, Oklahoma. Put him at UCLA. Put him at Mississippi Valley State. Doesn't matter. Marcus Smart would be an undeniable NBA talent. I wonder how much the escalated stock, as it is, of Mitch McGarry and Glenn Robinson was tied to Trey Burke really making them look good. And I wonder if that's not a lesson, although one that's maybe a little hard to admit, that if your stock is at an all-time high and it's possibly tied to the way somebody's making you look, a great player's making you look as opposed to what you really are, then perhaps you take advantage of it. Is that a fair assessment with McGarry and maybe even Robinson, that their stock was so high because of Trey Burke as much as it was because of them?
I think somebody had to have told them that, you know, along the way, just – you know, they have to know what their skill set is. You know, Glenn Robinson has to know that he got a lot of open shots because of Burke. McGarry has to know that he had a lot of open dunks and tippins because of Trey Burke. And, you know, someone in the process when they were deciding whether to go to the NBA or come back, someone had to have told them that. And I think, you know, like you said, it's hard to look at yourself and be like, well, you know, why can't I be so good without him?
Right.
And, you know, it's hard, but someone definitely told them that, and I think they should have realized that Burke was the reason that their stock was either lottery pick or mid first round or whatever it was, just because he was so good and he attracted so much defensive attention. Derek Walton, they had to have known he was not going to be Trey Burke right off the bat. And, you know, like you said, it's really hard to look at yourself and wonder why your skill set isn't, you know, on its own a lottery pick talent, but they should have realized that.
I mean, Norlander, what do you think? Is that something somebody, or let me ask you from this perspective, if you're Mitch McGarry and somebody sits down and says, listen, kid, we think you're great. Right now you're projected to go 12th in this draft for two reasons. A, because you were just phenomenal in the NCAA tournament, but also because this draft is weak. You might ought to go because for two reasons. A, next year's draft is deeper, so you could be better but slip. But secondly, and let's just be honest with you, kid, I think you're great, but is it possible, just think about this, is it possible you look better than you actually are? And now, because of Trey, and now that NBA scouts are going to be focused on you, and other teams are going to be focused on you, is it likely that you're going to look worse even if you're a better player because you're not playing with Trey Burke, and should we capitalize on that now? Is how hard would that be if you're Mitch McGarry to process? Because, you know, kids, all kids, and you guys know this as well as I do, probably Borzello better than both of us because he deals with 16 and 17-year-olds. Every top 100 player thinks he's going to the right. NBA. They never yes. think that they're not good enough. So I think trying to process the very likely scenario that you're not as good as you looked, you looked that good because of somebody who's no longer around, in this case Trey Burke, it must be very difficult to acknowledge, but probably would have been wise to acknowledge that, huh?
Yes. Well, and if you talk to a lot of coaches, they'll say any kid that's starting any kid that's starting in college basketball, no matter the level, thinks he's making the NBA, which obviously is an issue, but whatever. Yeah, and the other thing is, I don't know how many players can be truly self-critical and self-aware to that degree, that honest point. A lot of them say the right things to the media. But in terms of really being able to look at yourself and what you are and what NBA scouts see you as and what your potential is and maximizing that after 1 year, I think it's a tough thing for most 18 and 19-year-olds to grasp. And so, I don't know, I think that might have been something that McGarry might have factored in. But I think ultimately he thought, you know, he could get a little more out of his game. There might have been a good selfish streak in him that said, you know, this wasn't all Trey. And it wasn't, by the way. He was the player of the year last year. He was awesome. He took that team to the Final Four and, you know, two within a few buckets of winning the national title against Louisville. So, you know, them's the breaks. I don't think this will be a debilitating injury to the point where his career will be drastically different than if he had not had it. I just think it affects him in the here and the now, and he'll get that. In my opinion, he should get that junior year of college. He should come back and improve something then.
Yeah, you know what? If the worst thing that happens here is that he comes back to school, and I would think at this point he'd probably come back to school, because now leaving your stock would probably be at an all-time low. So what is the point? If you weren't in a rush to get there last year, I don't know why you'd be a rush to get there after a back injury. It seems like you'd want to rehab, come back, and prove your worth at the Division I level. And if the worst thing that happens here is a kid stays 4 years in school and then is a first-round pick, and like Mitch McGarry is still going to make millions of dollars playing basketball at some point, somewhere, you know? So if the worst thing that comes from all this is that he stays in school and actually develops as an amateur, it's not so bad. It's unfortunate because this is obviously not his plan. This wasn't anybody's plan. But my guess is we look up in 5 years, 6 years, whenever, Mitch McGarry's going to be doing okay. Let's talk actual basketball stuff, on the court stuff. And let's start with the big game from Saturday, at least the most high-profile game from Saturday, which was Kentucky-Louisville at Rupp Arena. Kentucky finally now has its signature win. Borzello, is everything cool in Lexington now?
I think it's cool in the way that now we see what the Harrison twins and James Young can do in terms of carrying the team. To me, their second half was amazing. You know, I think they had 25 of the 30 points for Kentucky in the second half, and you know those three kind of carried them once Julius Randle went out. See, to me, the thing is, when Randle comes back healthy, which is going to be the next game, he's not going to have cramps every game. Are they now going to, you know, keep trying to carry the offense and not freeze Randle out, but have him get fewer touches? I don't know. I think that him going out enabled those three to kind of be what they want to be, you know, in terms of scoring the ball and creating offense and really, you know, carrying the load offensively. And most people think that should be Randle's job. And now when all four of those guys are on the court, are they going to go back to, you know, the Harrisons trying to score and Randle not getting touches where he wants it, or Randle forcing shots and James Young not getting shots? So I think that, you know, the next game we're going to see what they could really do now that those three have confidence on the perimeter with Julius Randle inside. If those guys are all clicking and all those guys can gel together, you know, it's obviously a scary team. And I think that on Saturday we saw that the perimeter group, that backcourt, is certainly Final Four worthy.
They looked good, but let's go big picture here. All right, they beat Louisville at Rupp against a Cardinals team that its best win is against Southern Miss at home.
Yeah.
And their loss against North Carolina is against, obviously, a skittish Tar Heels team, and they did not look – Parrish saw that in person. They did not look good in that loss. So Louisville has not proven a lot to this point. I still think Louisville, in my opinion, is still a top 10 team, even though their resume and their schedule does not prove that whatsoever. Undeniably, right now, if you seeded a 68-team field, Louisville would have no business being a 1, a 2, a 3, or a 4 seed. They wouldn't. They don't have the strength of schedule to warrant that. So if you want to be a little pessimistic with Kentucky, that's entirely fair to say their one win came at home. They didn't look terrific. They didn't look bad at all, but they didn't like wow me in beating Louisville. They got what they needed to get done, and it was nice to see that they could recover when Randall was clearly suffering from cramps. I still feel like the Harrisons look good, but they're just not nearly as good overall or as consistent as I was expecting them to be. So Kentucky looks nice. SEC play starts in a little over a week here, and that league, by the way, has been absolute garbage. So here we have a situation where Kentucky is going to really have to rack up most of their wins in conference play to the tune of, I'm talking like winning at least 14 in out of an 18-game schedule, because the SEC has by far been the worst of those top leagues. They can't really afford to stumble too much here. So you feel good if you're a Kentucky fan, but by no means does this mean you're definitely a top three team again.
Are you guys worried about Louisville?
Well, here's what I was going to say. Like Norlander said, and I think this is true. Like listen, Kentucky, it's a great win because a loss would have sent your fan base going crazy, right? So it's a great win over a rival, over Rick Pitino, whatever. But Norlander made this point. They didn't like wow you while beating Louisville. And to me, that says more about Louisville than Kentucky, because Kentucky didn't have to play out of its mind or even with Julius Randle to beat Louisville. And though Kentucky's losses to Baylor, to Michigan State, and to North Carolina were all games in which they were, you know, Kentucky had a chance to win in the last 2 minutes of every one of those games, right? Like, they didn't win any of them. But the Michigan State game, I was there. It was, it was a one-possession game in the final minute. The Carolina game was a one-possession game in the final minute, and the Baylor game was, I don't remember the details, I watched it on television, but they had a chance to win at the end. They just didn't get it done. Louisville wasn't winning this game down the stretch. You know, like for the last 6-7 minutes, it was very clear Louisville's not winning the game. And for the last 10 minutes, roughly, of the game at the Mohegan Sun against North Carolina, like Louisville wasn't winning that game either. And so as we sit here on December 30th, Louisville, forget that they didn't play the schedule, because, if you're Rick Pitino, you don't have to. I mean, it'd be better. I think in hindsight, he probably wishes he would have. But like, the players are back. You're Rick Pitino. You're Louisville. You're going to get the benefit of the doubt. You're not fighting for respect. It wasn't as necessary as it is for some other schools, but they are sitting here at 11-2 with no good wins and two losses to whatever you think about North Carolina and Kentucky. Those schools ain't unbeatable. They both lost three times this year, and yet Louisville's lost to both of those teams and really didn't have a chance to beat them in the final minutes of either game. And so, am I concerned about Louisville? I guess if you told me to still take, I get 10 picks of who's going to win a national title, go.
Yeah.
Louisville would probably still be on my list. But I tell you, there is nothing I've seen with my own eyes that has made me think Louisville at this point is a legitimate national title contender. Now, if you would have asked me the same thing in January last year, I'd have probably said, I don't know. Like, didn't they get run off the court by somebody at some point?
Yeah, they had like a 3-game losing streak last year. And then it was funny. They dropped Cuse, Nova, Georgetown, decent teams last year. And that was end of January. And then their only other loss the entire year was that 5-OT game at Notre Dame. And I remember when they lost that, I thought they didn't have any chance at a number one just because they were 19-5 at that point. But obviously way off in that presumption. But I'm with you, by the way. Like, I still think they're one of the 10 best teams, even though they haven't proven it yet. And that could ultimately prove to be incorrect and wrong because, like, Shane Bohannon's disappearing act was downright disconcerting from a Louisville fan perspective. Like, you just can't have your big man be that ineffective as he was. And in the front court in general. And then Chris Jones had a decent game, but then he kind of tailored off. I don't know. Overall, there are concerns to be had with the Cardinals, for sure.
Yeah, and like, I guess like Rick's one of the best at getting things turned around. Like, so I if you count him out, you're being dumb. I mean, you're betting against a Hall of Famer with actual talent. You know, you give me a Hall of Fame coach and talent, like I'll believe in them until it's over. You know, like I'll believe that they can always flip a switch until it's over. So I'm never going to give up on this Louisville team. But although the Sagarin and KenPom still likes Louisville a lot, this is where I do think there's sometimes a breakdown between the computers and what you're actually seeing with your own eyes, because they have pounded bad teams.
Yeah, like, they're number one in KenPom right
now. Yeah, they've pounded bad teams. They pounded bad teams. But when they've only played two good teams, and to date, they have not looked good against either of those good teams. Norlander, I think you mentioned the SEC, in speaking about Kentucky, has been really, really garbage, and I think that's mostly true. And oddly, I wrote about this a little bit last night, it's having an effect on Wichita State, of all people. Wichita State, actually, Greg Marshall, I give him credit, like, scheduled about as aggressively as you can schedule if you're an MVC school that nobody's going to go visit, right? And he got, he went to St. Louis. He got Alabama, who goes to Alabama. He had Tennessee come into Wichita, and they're sitting here undefeated. And in theory, those three, and then got a win over BYU as well, right? So in theory, those four wins should be quality wins over four schools that were projected in the preseason to make the NCAA tournament. But Alabama has struggled, and Tennessee has struggled relative to preseason expectations. And it's weird that Wichita State's seed, like, we kind of already know this on December 30th. Porzello, you correct me if I'm wrong. We kind of already know on December 30th that Wichita State's seed is going to be directly tied to Alabama and Tennessee. And they need Alabama and Tennessee to get good. Otherwise, they're going to be sitting on Selection Sunday, Wichita State, with 30-plus wins, but very few quality ones. And if you don't think that that can affect your seeding, go ask Josh Pastner, who had 30, you know, wins, you know, like last year, and I think got a maybe a 7 seed or a 6. I don't remember what it was. Got an 8 a few years ago with a you know, like 28, 29 wins. So the idea, like, Wichita State could really run the regular season, win the MVC, and still not get a top 4 seed based off of, oddly, Tennessee and Alabama not being as good as they're supposed to be.
I mean, you could throw BYU into that. Yeah. I know we're talking about the SEC, but BYU, you know, when they beat BYU by double digits, it's like, all right, great. It was pretty good win. But now BYU's 8-6. They just lost by double digits to Loyola Marymount. They lost 3 in a row. So that win doesn't look as good either. And like you said, they could have a ton of wins, but the best one's going to be over St. Louis. And then, you know, who knows if any of those other teams are even NCAA tournament worthy. Is Indiana State going to, you know, be a second bid out of the MVC? Alabama, Tennessee, BYU. There's just not a lot of meat there. And when they beat Tennessee, I was wondering, are they going to have a 2 or 3 seed come March? And I think they're going to have enough wins because they're only going to have 1 or 2 losses. But, you know, when you compare them to what a school like, let's say Louisville, let's say they win a bunch of, they beat UConn, they beat Memphis. Those two wins are going to be way better than anything Wichita State has, even if Louisville has 3 or 4 more losses.
I will be very interested to see what the committee does with Wichita State, because I think most fans realize this, but some might, you know, they do entirely take it year by year. So what Wichita State did last year will not factor into how they are seeded this year. That said, they're you know, there's got to be some sort of tiny human element that creeps into this process. And if we get a Wichita State team that only has 2 losses come Selection Sunday, what the Shockers are going to need, basically, is they're going to need to beat Indiana State twice and then hope Indiana State does not lose any other game in the Valley to really give those Indiana State wins some more heft, because Tennessee is not what I thought they would be at all. You mentioned BYU is in serious. Like, I thought they would be a fairly good tournament-worthy team, and now, barring some serious damage in the WCC, they're not going to sniff the tournament. I mean, 8-6 is a huge disappointment. So, yeah, Wichita State's in a weird situation here where they actually did schedule well, and it could end up hurting them. You know, if they can run the table, the entire table, and remain undefeated as long as possible, that will actually help their case, because then if they can get to February without a loss, then the national conversation really hovers around them as well, and I feel like that will help them as well. But I don't think, given what they have here, I think their best case, and if they went undefeated, which they're not going to, I think they'd get a 2, but I don't think they're going to do that. So I think their best case is a 3, and if they get 2 losses, 2 losses could still be a 3, but we could be a 4 depending on what happens around them.
2 things. First off, like, it'd be ideal, obviously, if Indiana State, for Wichita State, took losses to Wichita State and then ran the rest of the Valley. Like, that's just not the way the Valley works. You know,
there's always the tough road game.
Yeah, like that league. Seth Davis actually said this on CBS the other day, and I don't know if it's absolutely right, but it's probably closer to true than people realize. Like, the Valley has terrific fans. Like, so, like, even in the Pac-12, you know, you might go to a USC and play in front of nobody, or go to a Washington State and play in front of nobody, or go into UCLA even and play
UCLA,
in front of, half in the Valley. You go places like you're playing in front of people. Like they draw crowds, and that tournament in St. Louis every year is just like unbelievable. I'm talking about 18,000 fans, like for the quarterfinals, for the semifinals, and for the championship game. And that's not something that every power conference can do. You know, the Big Ten can do it, the ACC can do it, but like, you know, you've seen the Pac-12 tournament at Staples Center or Vegas, wherever. They ain't drawing those type of fans so I just think it's unlikely that somebody like Indiana State's going to be able to go on the road and just, you know, sweep games against everybody against Wichita State. Beyond that, used a good term, human element, Norlander. And I wonder, again, I understand how the process works of seeding teams for the NCAA tournament. But, and I know in years past, talking to Greg Shaheen, he would tell you, who worked with the NCAA, he would tell you that something that really mattered is like non-conference strength of schedule. They wanted to see if you tried. Did you try to play people? All right, well, Wichita State's going to be interesting because their non-conference strength of schedule isn't going to be great. But it's not going to be an indication that they didn't try. Right. They actually tried. Like when you say, we'll go to Alabama, we'll go to St. Louis, and the St. Louis thing's going to hold up, I think. Although, with the Atlantic 10 having VCU, UMass being better than it's supposed to be, Dayton seemingly better than it's supposed to be, GW being better than it's supposed
to be. Yeah, they have like 8 or 9 good teams.
Yeah, like, no, well, let's not go crazy. But they have four.
Like 8 or 9 teams that they could lose to.
Yeah, well, the St. Louis thing's interesting. St. Louis could be really good. I think St. Louis is good. And they could take losses in the Atlantic 10 just because the Atlantic 10 at the top is going to be better than we thought. Seems to be better than we thought. But when you, Greg Marshall, and you say, yeah, we'll go to Alabama, yeah, we'll play Tennessee, yeah, we'll play BYU, you are, by definition, trying, because all of those teams are supposed to be in the NCAA tournament. What if Tennessee doesn't make it and Alabama continues to struggle? Then suddenly the NCAA selection committee, on one hand, could reasonably look at Wichita State and say, hey, they didn't play anybody in the non-league except for St. Louis. But on the other hand, don't you have to go, if you're on that committee, don't you have to go, at least in the spirit of the human element, go, listen, let's not punish Wichita State for not scheduling aggressively, because they at least did try. They tried to schedule the right team. It's not their fault that Anthony Grant, Konzel Martin didn't maximize talent. Is that fair? How do you balance those things?
I think people say that more when it comes to the non, you know, I guess, power conference teams. Like Wichita State, because if you're in the Big East, or, well, I guess the old Big East, you're going to play people no matter what, and the committee's going to see that you played a ton of teams. But I feel like it's always an excuse, I guess, for the non-power conference teams that, oh, they try to play this team, they try to play that team. I'm not saying it's wrong or whatever. I just think that if this same non-conference resume was for maybe Cincinnati, I don't think anybody would give them the benefit of the doubt.
No, but if you're Cincinnati, here's the deal. Like you in the old Big East, you get a slew of conference games against high level. Even in the American, you're going to get Connecticut twice, Memphis twice, Louisville twice, and that's going to give you at least six quality games, right? When you are in the Missouri Valley Conference, just like when you're in the West Coast Conference, let's bring St. Mary's into this conversation. When you're in a league like that, particularly now that Creighton's gone from the MVC, you know that you're not going to get Connecticut twice, Memphis twice, Cincinnati twice, Louisville twice, whatever. You're not playing an American Conference schedule, and that's the low end of the so-called good leagues. You're going to have to create your opportunities. You have to do it with your non-league schedule. And so, like, with St. Mary's, year after year, they don't really try to create opportunities with their non-league schedule. They'll get in some exempt tournament, and they'll play some games and whatever, but they don't aggressively, I don't think this is true, try to schedule in a way that's going to create a seeding. They just look like they're interested in stockpiling wins and getting into the tournament based on a number of wins instead of quality of wins. With Wichita State here, I think, and I remember when Turgeon was there. Do you remember when Wichita State, they went to the Sweet 16, right? Mm-hmm. And then they returned the bulk of that team. And Turgeon that year, like, actually decided. He was a Sweet 16 team that gets like 12,000 people a game, and he took a bye game opportunity from Syracuse. This is Mark Turgeon, which is nothing a program the caliber of Wichita State would do. Go be somebody's bye game, like it's Jackson State or something. But they can't. He said, listen, we're going to be. And I remember talking to Turgeon about this. He said, we're going to be good. Like we went to the Sweet 16, and we've got most of that team back. We're preseason top 25. And I can't get opportunities in my league. and I can't get anybody to come to Wichita State and play us, and I can't get any of these these neutral site events because they don't want Wichita State. They want Syracuse and Kentucky. So what did I have to do to create opportunities for my team? It's not ideal to take an $80,000 check to go to the Carrier Dome. I don't want to do that. I don't think we're that kind of program, but it's the only way I can get a game like that, and I need a game like I need high-caliber opponents. So they took a bye game at Syracuse, and they won it, right?
Yes, they did.
Right, and so I just remember—
weren't they not very good that year?
They spiraled, I think, towards the end of the
year. Yeah, I don't think they made the—
yeah, they did not make the NCAA tournament.
They were 17-9. I brought up their resume. They were 17-9 on February 11th.
How did they start? It was pretty impressive.
They started 9-0 with wins over a decent LSU team, yep, a year removed from the Final Four, and Syracuse. Those were the two big ones.
So they spiraled late, I think, because of injuries. But my point is that Turge recognized he was going to have a good team, and he went out and tried to do whatever he could, even if it meant taking a bye game at Syracuse to create opportunities, because he knew he wouldn't get them in the league. I think Greg Marshall, he didn't take a bye game at Syracuse. I get that. But if you're looking at this, you go, hey, Alabama's projected top five in the SEC. Let's get them. Tennessee's projected top five in the SEC. Let's go play that. St. Louis is St. Louis. Let's go play that. BYU is BYU. Let's go play that. That to me, that is scheduling aggressively. And it's unfortunate that's not going to work out that way. And I hope, though I know some Wichita State fans are listening and saying, Parrish, well, you're holding it against them in the top 25 and one. Whatever. I don't actually.
Yeah, you are.
Well, here's what I would say. If you look at the resume, like right now, like 17 is about where they ought to be. Like, I think they're going to be top 10 when the AP polls announced today, released today, updated today. And I think 17 is close. Let's just, whatever the number really should be, I think 17 is closer to it than 9 is. But whatever, I'm not interested in it. If somebody ranks, I won't use the poll attacks to rip somebody for ranking Wichita State high. Rank them number one. It won't bother me at all. They're undefeated. They're good. I don't have an issue with it. But I would say this. On Selection Sunday, I'm not saying if they go undefeated or even with a one loss, two loss, they deserve a one seed or a two seed. But I would have a problem with the committee looking at Wichita State's resume, citing it for a lack of quality wins and seeding them 7 in the East. Even though Greg Marshall did everything he could do. That's what I mean. I would have a problem with that.
I don't think that'll happen. I don't, unless, you know, if they take on water in the conference and
they lose
drop,
like 5 NBC
games, if they lost 5, I don't even think they'd get a 7, to be honest, because of the overall strength of schedule. So, I don't know. We'll see. Hey, quick question I want to ask you guys. So Syracuse wins, right? And this looks awesome. In recent years, you know, Jim Boeheim, last year, team won 30 games. 2012 team started 20-0. Ultimately was a one seed that won 34 games. The 2010 team won 30 games. How good is this one compared to those other ones? I mean, last year's team made the Final Four, remember, and kind of snuck its way in there. People didn't really expect them to do that. But behind, you know, obviously a future lottery pick with Carter Williams, they were able to get past Indiana as a four seed and get there. I'm starting to think this team is on the level of every other recent team. That 2010 team had Andy Routens, Wes Johnson, a young Scoop Jardine, Rick Jackson. His injury later in his career obviously hurt them. But I don't know, guys. I am really, really liking what Ennis does. And he's not even like – I wrote about this. He's not even super quick, super strong. He's not really big. He's just savvy, crafty, and is – as a freshman – making an impact, which does not happen. Obviously, Carmelo Anthony is once and forever the example of a freshman doing something amazing in college basketball, let alone in Syracuse. But most of the time, first-year guys don't get a lot of minutes and action for Boeheim. Ennis is proving that to be incorrect, and it's been awesome. So I just didn't know where you thought this year's team stacks up to the ones in the past 3 or 4 years that have been 31 clubs.
I think they're terrific. And let's be fair, like, Boeheim was sort of trapped into this Ennis thing. Like, he was going to have to play Tyler Ennis no matter what, right? Once Michael Carter-Williams turned into Michael Carter-Williams, and I think Jim's actually said this, like, Tyler didn't commit to Syracuse under the idea that he would be the freshman starting point guard. I think at best, coaches always do this. They sit around with a piece of paper and they start talking about, okay, lineup combinations for next year based on who they're going to bring back and who they're going to enroll. At the time Tyler Ennis committed to Syracuse, my guess is Jim Boeheim thought Michael Carter-Williams would be on this team as well. So you're thinking either Tyler Ennis is a reserve as a freshman, which is fine, or that you're playing them together, right? Because Michael's got some size and you can get away with playing them together, and boy, to have two ball handlers and blah, 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 blah. Well, the idea that Tyler Ennis is now solely the starting point guard for Syracuse is a bit of a byproduct of the roster more than anything else, of Michael Carter Williams, sort of a launch to stardom than anything else. But that said, sometimes you luck into these decisions. Like you get in, like your hand is forced by circumstances, and then you go, "Oh wow, I didn't even really know what I had, but look at what I got." And I think that might be the case with Tyler Ennis. And I think Jim would tell you this. Like he obviously liked Tyler, but did he think Tyler Ennis was going to be this? I don't think anybody thought Tyler Ennis was going to be this.
He committed August before his senior season in high school. So this was,
last year.
Yeah, after 1 year of Michael Carter Williams, which was obviously not all that impressive. And like you said, I mean, I think they thought he would get 1 year under MCW, learn the position, learn whatever, and then play. And now he was forced into the position. They have no backcourt depth. You know, Trevor Kuhn is the only other guard on the roster, along with, Michael Benajay is a wing. But weaknesses, they don't really get much inside play. They don't have a lot of guards. But with Tyler Ennis, he's that guy that, we always say, well, you want a point guard that's pass first, makes everyone better. And he's done it from day one. I didn't expect him to do this right off the bat. I knew he'd be, one of the most, quote unquote, important freshmen in the country, but I didn't think he would be, maybe a top three freshman right now, performance wise.
Turnovers is the big thing for me, the lack of them. You don't really see that often in college, especially with a freshman. I might run some numbers here this week just to see how he compares historically, because he's only got 13 turnovers in what are we at now? 12 games for Syracuse.
His season high is 2. That's insane.
Ridiculous. It's almost like there's going to be a regression to the mean. Not that he's going to become this wildly irresponsible player, but this kind of value and taking care of the ball as a starting point guard freshman for a major conference team. You just don't kind of see that's very, very impressive for them overall. So I really, really like them. I would still take Arizona over them right now, but I mean, just by a hair, just in seeing what they did at home, big game, Villanova, and for Ennis, I mentioned it in the post I wrote, this was the biggest game of his life, and going up against his big brother, there had to be some nerves there as well. He was fantastic, 20 points, no turnovers. So yeah, SU heading into the ACC, I feel that they've got as much claim to that league title as anyone, including Duke, because they've been impressive, and they do not have a typical weak non-conference Syracuse schedule. You can knock them for not really playing any away game except St. John's at the Garden, and you can throw in your cynical remark about SU at MSG. But Minnesota, again, better than we thought they'd be. Good. Cal, okay. Baylor, obviously, top 10, top 15 team. IU should be a tournament team. Win over St. John's, really talented, and now beating undefeated Villanova. This is a team right now, the best offensive in the country, better than I thought they'd be, and they very well could be the best Syracuse team since that 03 title team. Just got to see what they do in a decent but underachieving ACC.
No, they were terrific, and what I liked a lot about what happened Saturday is not just that they won the game, because they were supposed to win the game, right? I mean, they're at home, and yeah. they were technically favored. You're supposed to win the game. But you got a freshman point guard. You're on national television, CBS. You've got, Carrier Dome, massive crowd. And then you're down, 18 early? Like,
yeah. 25-7, yep.
Yeah, okay, so you're down. And, there was never any sense of, all right, let's get it. A lot of times with teams, particularly teams led by a young, and I'm not saying he's the leader, I recognize CJ Fair's on the team, but a young point, there's these instincts of let's get it all back. We got to tie the game. We got to hit a 17-point shot or an 18-point shot. And there was none of that. Even when they were down, 25, I guess 7 was the – you didn't sense that there was any sort of panic, and they just sort of boom, boom, boom. Next thing you know, they're in it again. And then they actually run away with it. And it reminded me a little bit on a different end of the spectrum, what Louisville did to them last year in the Big East tournament. Just completely, after falling behind, just ran them off the court. And it was just really impressive. And I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, but it's always worth repeating. Nobody debates Krzyzewski's place in college basketball history or Patino's place in college basketball history. And I know Jim Boeheim's a Hall of Famer, but I still don't think people properly recognize how hard it is to be consistently not good, but great. And he has been consistently great with completely different rosters in most years, relying on completely different people. And that's just not easy to do. And what he's been able to do there, I don't know you know, again, I recognize he is already in the Hall of Fame. So that is some sort of confirmation of his greatness. But if you were to right now, I think off the top of your head, you just call somebody you know who watches college basketball and say, give me top five coaches in America. I don't know how many people would throw Boeheim on that list, but I think he probably belongs on that list.
Agreed. Absolutely.
Well, listen, guys, we've taken up enough time. Plus, I probably need to get back. And I haven't heard a baby cry in 50 minutes, which is like a record.
You could have used this time to take a nap. You're probably regretting that right now.
It is so crazy. Like, imagine what it's like to have to wait. And I know I'm speaking to everybody who's ever had a kid, except this wasn't the experience with our first son. To be awake every 50 minutes. Like, you were going to wake up every 50 minutes. And then you could go back to sleep, you know, but you're going to wake up again in 50 minutes. Like, it's miserable. Like, it's whatever, right? I'll get used to it, I hope.
Yeah, man. Well, listen, enjoy your new year. When do you get to go home?
Like, the doctors could theoretically have come in the past 50 minutes and said, you guys are free to go. We're definitely going home, like, at some point soon. Like, I'll be home before tonight. And so, and then we'll get home. And it's actually, like, not an ideal time to have a child if you cover college basketball for a living, except it kind of has – the timing has been pretty good because it came after Christmas, so it didn't mess up Santa and all that for our 10-year-old. And it allowed him to be able to spend Christmas at home and wake up that morning and walk downstairs and have all of that. But then, like, I was already off of radio last Thursday and Friday. I was already not going to be on the road this weekend because the due date was the 30th. We got New Year's, which means I'm off radio till Thursday no matter what. There's not a whole lot going on in college basketball today, tomorrow, Wednesday, really this week until the weekend. So it's actually worked out pretty well where if you've got to take some time to be in a hospital for 3 days, the timing has actually been...
Good timing, Chief. Yeah. You planned this out well.
I did not plan this... Not only did I not plan it well... I didn't plan it at all. Did not plan it at all, but we're really lucky. Again, let me thank everybody for sending nice notes over the past few days. We read all of them, and they really meant a lot, not only to me, but also to Kelly. Remember, you guys can listen to the pod over on iTunes. You can actually subscribe. That's the quickest way to get it. So go to iTunes, do a search for Ion College Basketball Podcast. It should pop right up. Again, it's the quickest way to make sure you get the latest podcast. So go subscribe. It's free, and either way, thanks to you guys, and I'll talk to everybody else a little later on this week. Take care.